Today's podcast is sponsored by RadRx, your source for quality online education for interventional and diagnostic radiology coding, taught by subject matter expert Stacy Buck. For more information and testimonials, visit RadRx.com. Struggling to learn interventional radiology coding? If so, RadRx has the perfect solution for you. Cracking the IR Code, Mastering Interventional Radiology and Cardiology online training program. In this program, interventional radiology coding expert Stacy Buck breaks down the complexities of interventional radiology coding in easy-to-understand terms so you can grasp this complex specialty. Through her course, Stacy has assisted many coders with little or no interventional radiology coding experience in successfully passing the CIRC exam on the first attempt. For additional information and testimonials, visit RadRx.com. Welcome to Who Cares What Stacy Says, a podcast providing insights and advice on how to take your medical coding career to the next level. And now, here's your host, Stacy Buck.
Welcome to Who Cares What Stacy Says. I am your host, Stacy Buck. In today's episode with Rosemeen Boppet, President of CodeRight Healthcare Consulting, and Tony L. Holmes, CEO of Alpha Coding Experts, we wrap up our discussion of Dr. Marnie McCary's book, The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. This book is a must-read for everyone, but in particular, it's a must-read for anyone working in the healthcare industry. In his book, Dr. McCary shines a light on business practices within healthcare that drive up costs for all of us, and he takes a deep dive into the many reasons why healthcare costs are so high, and he also showcases individuals who are disrupting the status quo of healthcare delivery. Rosemeen, Tony, and I continue to discuss what we learned from Dr. McCary's book, as well as sharing insights based on our personal experiences, both as patients and as healthcare professionals. And now here is part three of my interview with Rosemeen and Tony. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it's the way we've always done things. You always had health insurance, and it's what we relied on, you know, for healthcare. And for a long time, it worked, and, you know, fairly well. I think it's interesting how healthcare has evolved when we switched to HMOs. We remember when those were brand new, although I know how old Tony is. I don't know how old you are, like Rosemeen, but I remember healthcare before HMOs. And then HMOs came about, and it's like, oh, this is going to save us money in healthcare. And HMOs didn't really save money. What I think happened with HMOs, because before HMOs, you really were following more of like a PPO model where you had patients that were paying a portion of the services that were rendered. So now we're in this HMO PPO world. And then you had the problem with HMOs, they were not authorizing care, and then patients were having bad outcomes. So they had to relax, you know, that their requirements, and they had to allow like more access. So, okay, we try to control access, but we really can't do that because they went overboard. And so that could help cost somewhat. But then on the flip side of that, like you just said, if you have a situation where the patient is never receiving a bill and they're never paying a portion, they will just keep going and getting healthcare. So if you have an HMO where you have, you know, no copay, or maybe you have a really low copay, now they're higher than they used to be. But if you could go see your doctor for, say, $10, you know, maybe you're going to go see your doctor, you know, for $10. Now, if you're in a PPO model where maybe you're paying a percentage of charges, the traditional ones like from years ago, you have skin in the game. If it's going to cost you money, you're going to think twice before you go seek a service if you have to pay out of pocket. So I feel like patients, for the most part, have to have some skin in the game where they're paying something for services, and they have that vested interest in making a good choice, a good financial choice, because if the insurer is on the hook and they're not going to be paying anything out of their pocket, they are not going to care about cost. That is not even going to be a factor. So I think that HMOs, in a way, did kind of help push healthcare costs up, because then you have people who are paying little or nothing out of their pocket to go seek services, where myself, and I've been insured and I've not been insured. When I'm insured, I'm more likely to go see a provider when something's bothering me. When I'm uninsured, I wait and see. And I'm like, hey, how am I going to progress before I go seek out treatment for this. And then some things pass and you're fine and you don't need to see anybody. And I think if the consumer has to pay a portion, then they're more likely to make better choices in that regard. With that said, there needs to be the safety net for those people who cannot afford that. Obviously, we always need to have that. You know, we need to rethink how that's done too. I mean, we can talk about what a mess like Medicaid coverage, you know, is and how we should have reform for Medicaid. And there's a lot of talk about Medicare for all. And when I hear Medicare for all, I'm like, do people not understand that Medicare doesn't work right now the way it is? I don't think that that's the solution. I understand where people are going and where they want to go when they talk about this universal coverage, but you can't take a broken model and apply universal coverage in a broken model. It will bankrupt the country. There's absolutely no way to provide the healthcare that we need in the system that we're currently working in. I don't care what you do. I don't care how much money you throw at it. It's throwing more money at the problem will never fix the problem. And as we saw years ago with what everybody calls Obamacare, you know, but it's the Affordable Care Act. It's kind of like the law of unintended consequences. You solve a problem here. So you got insurance to people who desperately needed it, you know, with this, and they have coverage. And to this day, they still do. But then you have a segment of people that ended up paying more for insurance. Some people couldn't go to the same doctors. The doctors weren't available to them on the plans that they had. And then you had someone like me in those transition years where I was stuck in this uninsured. Now, the good thing was, hey, I had a pre-existing condition. Now I really did. I didn't get insurance before because they tagged me incorrectly. Now I had a year of healthcare where nobody could figure out what was wrong with me. So I definitely have pre-existing. Now Obamacare is available to me at that time. And then when I look at the premiums and I look at the cost, when business was really low for several years and I wasn't making a lot of money, I'm like, well, the deductible's too high, the premium's too high, and I cannot afford to do this on a monthly basis. So even though it was available to me, I'm one of those people that still didn't have access to it. You have other people that got pushed out of what they had. So we insured people who weren't insured before. We have other people who still can't get insured. And then we have people who were insured that now don't have insurance. But then I'm paying the penalty for not having insurance, which was kind of interesting. And so that was going up every year, but the penalty was cheaper than actually purchasing an insurance plan. And so I got stuck with that. And so again, we fixed one problem, but we created another set of problems because there's only so much money to go around. And then still you've left all the power with the insurance companies. Once again, they're the ones that are really calling the shots as far as that's concerned. And so I don't know what the answer is. I we've talked about these alternative models and I love that idea that if these could catch on, but I feel like somebody has to step in on the insurance companies. And I just don't know that we're at a place in this country that that's going to happen with all the special interests, you know, like I mentioned, and that's really where you need to get at it. Unless the consumers on a wide scale basis, like, you know, this radical idea we've been talking about, you don't really need health insurance. Pull out. You can do with what? You know, people don't want to think about living in a world where they don't have health insurance. And I know when they did bring the Affordable Care Act in, there were certain policies that could no longer be offered, that you had minimum requirements that had to be put in policies. Well, these bare bones policies worked well for certain people. They were cost effective. Now you've taken the ability away to have these types of policies. It's almost like they're trying to create a one size fits all. And there's just simply not a one size fits all in healthcare. So I feel like we need multiple different options to fill that gap. So do either one of you want to comment more on pricing or transparency or talk about surprise billing? Because there's one topic I want to get to before we wrap up because it is near and dear to me because it's in my... I don't want to finish without talking about it. So any thoughts on the pricing, Tony, or surprise billing? Because that's the latest thing now. The government is stepping in with the Surprise Billing Act. And I'm like, here again, we have a lot of issues with legislation that we put forward that's not necessarily solving the problem that we have here. It's kind of headed in the right direction, but it's not quite enough.
Well, it's like you fix one problem and you create 10 more problems. It's just like this trickle down effect. That's the $1 trillion question. How do we fix this very broken system? So I mean, I'm personally, I personally subscribe to the idea that the free market approach is the best approach, right? Transparency, transparent pricing stabilizes prices. We've seen it with procedures like LASIK eye surgery, right? LASIK used to be incredibly expensive. Now the average price is about $4,500 for both eyes. We've only seen those prices decrease because of transparency, right? Because of the demand that we see, what you're charging versus what your competitors are charging. We also have seen that with IVF, right? So IVF is traditionally not covered by insurance. Now we have out-of-pocket transparency. Okay, you're going to get IVF. One cycle is going to cost you $15,000. We've seen IVF costs go down because of this transparency. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very, very good. Do I have all of the answers? No. I do think, and I'll just put this out there, as far as price transparency and making hospitals comply with price transparency rules, you're going to have to increase those penalties a heck of a lot more than $2 million a year.
Definitely.
$2 million a year, they make that in less than an hour. That's no...
They're making that on all their markups. Why would they even want to share their information?
So your maximum total penalty for a large hospital is $2 million. Like that is, that's nothing to them. If you start getting into the 50 million, 100 million mark, yeah, you might get their attention a little bit more. But again, this whole book is about the price we all pay because there's so much collusion. I saw this personally when I used to live in Colorado. There were a lot of deals being made with surgeons and like neuromonitoring companies, right? So they would make these deals behind the scenes where they would have these kickbacks flowing between the neurosurgeon and the neuromonitoring company, and the neuromonitoring company is out of network, or the surgical assist is out of network, or the anesthesiologist is out of network. The patient doesn't know anything about that. You know, they've done their due diligence.
Yes.
They know the hospital's contracted. Mm-hmm. They know their provider's contracted. That's going to do the surgery. But what they don't know is that the surgical assist is not, the anesthesiologist is not, the neuromonitoring is not. And so you just, the consumer gets screwed over and over and over again. So these types of deals that happen behind the scenes, and it's even the insurers, right? The insurers are colluding with the hospitals to inflate the charge masters. It's just crazy, corrupt, and it absolutely needs to be overhauled, demoed. We need to start over from the ground up.
It needs to be priced like every other service. Like we were talking about earlier, we don't buy anything else that way where it's like we pick out what we want and then whatever they tell us the price is, we pay it. Nothing works that way. In healthcare, unfortunately, some of it's already rendered. You have no choice, but it's nice now that there is more transparency. There are websites now you can go to and you can, you know, look at average prices for services and whatnot. One thing that I found interesting from the book is they were talking about facilities with price transparency, that they had a 50% increase in volume and a 30% increase in revenue, which I found like fascinating. And there was an increase in patient satisfaction, obviously. So if you're doing right by your patients as far as transparency, it's like it pays for itself. It's like you're going to get more patients, you're going to have the volume, you're going to be profitable. Yet we're still, I feel like the facilities almost feel like, again, like we're so accustomed to health insurance. We can't imagine a world without health insurance. The facilities cannot imagine a world without these inflated charges. Like how would we make any money if we didn't have these inflated charges? Well, there are providers out there who have figured out how to do it. It actually is possible. Hospitals are more challenging, obviously, for many reasons. The overhead situation is very different. But we kind of touched on in our different comments, the administrative burden in healthcare in the US is insane. I would bet you there's not one other country in the civilized world where, or uncivilized definitely, where we have such administrative burdens to get things paid. I mean, our reimbursement system is insane. I mean, just look at ICD-10 and how long it took to get ICD-10 adopted. I went to my first ICD-10 seminar back in 1997 because it should have gone in around the year 2000, but then it got bumped because of Y2K and then kicked the can down. I mean, the world was on ICD-10 in the 90s. We were like not, but because we have this ridiculous reimbursement system where we need the stupid modification of everything and we need PCS and all this other garbage. And then again, everybody has their political skin in the game. Look at the American Medical Association that lobbied against that for years. And then other organizations that pushed the delay. And when did it finally go into effect? Was it October 1st, 2016? Was that finally there? 2015. I don't even know. It's like forever. So, and now other countries are adopting ICD-11. And I'm working with a client now and they're like, oh, blah, blah, ICD-11. Do we need to? I go, you're building this product for US coders. No, do not even talk to me about ICD-11 yet because we are years away from it. You got to go through the whole, you know, rulemaking process, blah, blah. I'm like, it's not even on the radar in the United States. Let's not even talk about that. But it is. It's because of the complexities of our reimbursement system. And we are so heavily regulated. And so how much value is really in the complexities and all the regulation that we have? That's where if you could eliminate a lot of the overhead, a lot of the administrative burden, like you talk about in the physician practice, like an FTE and a half to do pre-authorization, that is ridiculous that it requires that many resources just to get pre-authorization to do a procedure. There's absolutely no reason. That's just one example of many. And then billing, like on the back end, trying to get things paid. Just because you get a pre-auth doesn't mean you're going to get paid on the back end either. That's you pre-authorized it, but then you'll deny it for some other reason and not pay for it, which just it's this vicious cycle that we're caught in and trying to chase down that money. So, Rosemean, what are your final thoughts on this topic?
For price transparency, as Tony said, if the penalties are not going to increase because it's not going to get solved. Nothing's going to get solved. The hospitals are just going to opt to pay the penalty, and then they're still going to keep the prices a secret because that it works for them. It's worked for them for years and years and years, and they don't want to change anything. You know, change is scary, right? They don't want to change anything because of the fact that they're thinking in their minds about losing the money, but on the contrary, you can see that, you know, transparency will bring you more business because I also feel that people who don't have insurance do stay away from treatment and going to the doctor and stuff because yes. They feel it's so expensive, right? Mm-hmm. If the prices are listed, they will be motivated to go get that, you know, that little lesion checked out or something, you know, that could turn into cancer. You know, then you're costing the government, you know, even more, you know, so I like I said, I don't know what the solution is here, but you know, hopefully we're moving in the right direction. So that's all.
Yeah. I feel like with the whole price transparency thing, that there's an easy solution to it that can come from the government. So they're focused on fining these facilities for not publishing this information. All you have to do is say this: if you accept money from the Medicare and Medicaid programs, it is mandatory that you post your prices. If you don't, you cannot participate in the Medicare Medicaid program. End of story. That will solve the problem.
Again, it's politicized. That's the issue. And the American Hospital Association is very powerful.
I agree. But see, that's the point. There is a simple solution. But why do we not implement simple solutions? Because of politics.
Because
that's
of special interests.
In healthcare. Exactly. That there's so much money in healthcare. And again, going back to the lobbying, there's practical solutions that don't get implemented. It is that simple. If you can tell employers that if you accept Medicaid and Medicare dollars, all of your employees need to be vaccinated, which is what they were doing. See, again, political, because they want to put, they can enforce it there. I'm not going to get into a vax conversation here on this podcast. But they used that because I'm like, why? Because I had this question. Why are we having people like working from home doing this? And I'm kind of trying to wrap my brain around it. And why are they enforcing this? And I couldn't understand my facility to make it happen. And then I heard if you are accepting money from Medicare and Medicaid, they're making it mandatory. That's why everyone has to do it. And I was like, okay, so you're using your power there to enforce that. So again, to me, it seems like an easy solution over here. If you really wanted them to be like, Why are we opposed to holding your feet to the fire about being completely transparent here? And you're right. The American Hospital Association, huge, you know, with lobbying, just like the American Medical Association, like huge, and push back on a lot of things. And then you have all of the companies that represent, or the lobbyists that represent insurance companies and that whole thing. So I feel like the elected officials who, I call them elected officials, I don't like using representatives because I don't feel like they represent most of the people, even though they're on both sides. I mean, this is like apolitical. I think both parties have done a horrible job in representing the average person. It's like they go out there and they talk about the little guy, but they're not actually doing anything that's helping the little guy. They're actually beholden to these larger entities. And that's why we don't get the problems fixed in healthcare. Okay. So the last thing, go ahead, Tony.
Stacy, can we get an ICD-10 code for delayed care due to prior authorization? Like, where are the codes to track the insurers? Like, this is
right there.
That's good. I mean, everybody's so focused on social determinants of health. I think that's something that should be looked at as well.
Nothing cannot be denied for medical necessity.
We need some codes for that because the struggle is real for providers.
True.
Yes, definitely. You know, and again, we have a unique perspective because we see it from the provider side and we see it from, you know, the patient, you know, side, and, you know, because, you know, we are patients, and I don't ever want people to think that I'm like trying to slam healthcare providers or doctors or take a side. It's like, I feel for healthcare providers. I've worked in hospital settings. I know the challenges that hospitals face. I'm not wanting it to sound like hospitals are just out there to rip you off. And they're like, no, that's not how I'm trying to come across and paint. There are a lot of great facilities out there. There are just challenges that they face. And you have a lot of hospital systems. Tony's laughing. She's muted, but she's laughing. But they face so many challenges. And I get that, having worked in the hospital system, you have a lot of hospitals out there that are not profitable or barely turn a profit. You know, there's also, I think, this idea that the public has in general, that everybody working in healthcare, doctors and hospitals and all the facilities, they're all rich fat cats, just getting rich off the backs of like everyone. And I'm like, that's simply not true across the board. But what catches the attention of everyone are these stories that you see on the news about the outrageous hospital bills and things of that nature. And then you read Dr. McCary's book, and he is showing some of those egregious examples and these horrible things that are happening. But certainly we have a lot of great people out there doing a lot of great things. But there are some people who just have a general distrust of the industry. And I understand why, because I think of the lack of transparency and, again, how it's portrayed. Do we ever see in the news a positive story about the healthcare industry that I can think of? Like, I don't know that we really see, other than new, maybe technologies or something like that. I'm like, I don't know that I see a whole lot of positive PR on that side, which we definitely need. Okay, so before we wrap up, the one last thing I want to talk about from the book, this is something that when I read this, I'm like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize this was occurring. And that was in the opening chapter of the book where Dr. McCary talked about community health fairs and providers who are going to community health fairs and getting patients referred to them from community health fairs. And the reason why this struck at me was because they talked about, in the book, talked about them doing vascular screenings, the lower extremity screenings. And then these patients are getting screened at the health fairs where they're doing the ABIs. And then based on the ABIs, they're like, well, there might be a problem here. You should go see a physician, they can further evaluate you. So then they go to the vascular doc, and then the vascular doc is a duplex scan. Well, now I think you need an angiogram, and then now you've got the angiogram, and I think we need to place a stent in your extremity. And a lot of these patients who they were getting from the health fairs, these procedures were medically unnecessary. This is a predatory form of marketing, but they are leading these patients to believe that they needed these services. Again, it goes back to what a physician tells you, you tend to trust what the physician tells you. And it was predatory in that they tended to go into lower income areas, and they're going into churches, they're going into synagogues and like mosques, and they're doing these free screenings. And the one pastor in the one church that Dr. McCary talked to, the pastor felt like, we're doing this as a community service. We're giving, you know, this is a benefit, you know, to our congregation. And they believe they're doing the right thing. He was completely unaware of what actually was going on with these patients being funneled to the physicians for the expensive surgical procedures eventually. So you have medically unnecessary procedures that are being done on these patients, and they're getting money from Medicare and other insurers. You know, in some cases, because they're in lower income areas, you may have a situation where the patient's on Medicaid, so they're billing Medicaid, and they don't necessarily care if they ever collect from the patient because they've already collected the money from the insurance company. And so this just really got to me because I see leg procedures every single day in my job with interventional radiology, working with the IR docs and the vein docs. And I was shocked that this was occurring on such a large scale. McCary had said that there were 1,100 churches, synagogues, and mosques that were doing screening exams on patients, which I just thought was absolutely amazing. And he talked about how patients who have leg pain, like they asked the person, do you have leg pain? Well, after a certain age, everybody's probably going to have leg pain, certain degree, certain circumstances. And so they're using that. Well, oh, you have leg pain, so you should get this test done and then have this service done. When it's been shown that less than 5% of leg pain actually benefit from an intervention. So there's a very high number of medically unnecessary procedures that are being performed in this space. And so, Rosemean, I know you had this on your list of things that you wanted to talk about, so I'll let you comment on it first, and then we'll jump over to Tony because I saw her making a face.
So I may have volunteered at one or two of these health fairs. You know,
but that's just like the premise that they put out there as to why you would never think that you have these nefarious individuals participating in doing these things. That would never have occurred to me.
No, first of all, because you're doing it in a place of worship. You know, it's a based kind of a thing. So it's very sacred. People come in trust. You know, they trust the organization that's putting the health care together. They trust the doctors that are actually volunteering, because the doctors are doing it out of, you know, the goodness of their heart, because they're volunteering their time on a Sunday. These are their community doctors that are coming in and doing these screenings for free. So it builds that trust and that sacred relationship, you know. And then, of course, whatever the doctor says, you know, you listen to them, and if they give you that indication that something is wrong, or that you have this problem that needs further evaluation, the patient, if they're, of course, you know, they're insured, they're going to go, and they're going, then they're going to go through the battery of tests and everything. And the end goal is the stenting and ballooning. That was the end goal in this particular instance. So there's so many things that are wrong here. And I will tell you this, that some doctors, because they're so angry at the system, because they're not getting paid for their time, because they're not getting paid fairly, because the Medicare reimbursements have come down so much, they got to pay for things. They got to pay for that house. They got to pay for that car. They got to pay for their living expenses. So they're doing this. I don't know where the moral compass and all that comes in. I don't want to get into that, but you can't, two wrongs cannot make a right, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, yeah, you are being victimized by all these regulations and things like that, but then you also then kind of go prey on these people who you're diagnosing with some unnecessary diagnosis in order to do the procedure. And of course, like we said earlier in this podcast, is that the fee for service system incentivizes the procedures, you know, the doctors who do the procedures get paid more money. So I found it very disturbing. I feel like I've seen this firsthand. Didn't realize what was happening at the time, but this was something that really, when I was reading it, I was like, oh yeah. I know this. I know this happens, you know. So that's what I got out of this story.
Yeah, I mean, I knew that it happened, and I knew that there were a lot of unnecessary interventions being performed. It's also, it happens with cardiology too, you know, with the, you know, cardiologist and placing stents and doing procedures and whatnot. That's something that's been going on for years. And McCary touches on this a little bit in the book, you know, going back to the Hippocratic Oath, you know, do no harm to the patients, and you're putting patients through unnecessary procedures. And I don't know if doctors think about that at all, who are doing unnecessary procedures, if they're rationalizing it, if they say to themselves, well, the risk is low to my patient of like a bad outcome, so it's worth doing it. Because I mean, the peripheral procedures, the catheter based stuff, definitely less risky than doing like other procedures. They're not high risk. However, anytime you are sticking anything in a patient, doing anything invasive, you are putting them at risk. And there are patients who have procedures done and then end up having bad outcomes. And if the procedure was medically unnecessary, now they've developed a complication from that medically unnecessary procedure, and you have harmed your patient to make that extra money. And it does happen. It may not be very common, but it happens. And that's where I kind of question the physicians. I don't know how far ahead they think, if they even think about that at all, or maybe some just don't know. I know, going back to what we talked about in the beginning with the outliers, you know, doing the data analysis, when they went back and were educating some of these physicians about what was common practice and what was acceptable, some of the physicians didn't even realize that their practice patterns were outliers until they were educated. And then they actually made some changes there. And I feel that.
I will interrupt you here. I'm sorry, but I think they know. I just think that when you show them the mirror, that's when they're like, oh, I got caught here. I'm going to change my ways here. That's how I see it. I don't know. Maybe too blunt here. I don't know.
No, I'm sure there are a lot out there who are like that. I have, you know, like I said, I work with a lot of hospitals, but over the years, I've dealt with a lot of physicians, and I've had a lot of conversations with physicians, and I see where they push the envelope, what they're trying to get away with, what they're willing to do. And it is about money. So they're definitely out there where it is just about money. And again, like you say, they feel like, okay, you know, with the system, they feel like they're being victimized by it. Well, now I need to step in and I need to figure out a way to like make money. So it's almost like they find a way to game the system. And I think they justify in their mind maybe why they're gaming the system, because they have to make that money, like you say. And again, it goes back to changing the system, the way it's structured. The more procedures you do, the more you get paid. It's just that simple. And until we fix that, where we go back to, again, what I said when we opened up, the book was about over-testing, over-treating, over-prescribing, and then overcharging. That's what it comes down to across the board. So until we fix that model, none of that is going to go away. That's just, you know, those are my thoughts on that. But yeah, that one really hit home, because these are procedures that I see every single day. And I think about that story so frequently. And like you say, it's occurring in a place of worship. You would never think that someone is going to be in there preying upon you, trying to get you to go have some medically unnecessary service done. And to the pastor's credit, when he found out what was going on, this particular pastor, he kicked the group out of the health fair. They were not allowed to like come back. So I think it's a matter of creating awareness about these community health fairs and looking for some healthcare providers that may be in there just for a financial benefit and not simply doing it out of the goodness of their heart. And there are people out there like that. So Tony, what are your thoughts on this?
I read this. I mean, it was just unbelievable, right? It's disheartening. It's deceitful. And obviously this is not targeted towards all physicians, right? Like all providers. Correct. The vast majority of providers want to do the right thing and really do care about patients, and they're not in it for financial gain. So I don't want this to be misconstrued as us harping on physicians or providers or hospitals, because no, generally
there's a segment of providers out there that are predatory. Yes, we see it all the time. It's just something that, you know, we see in the field.
Yeah. So in regards to the endovascular procedures, I think we've seen a lot more physician owned or physician that have interest in these private vascular centers. And so it makes you question how much of this is actually medically necessary. So McCary talks about it in the book. One day of leg artery procedures can generate $100,000 just in one day if they're doing it in their facility.
I can tell you firsthand, it can generate more than that, depending upon some of the insurance plans and like what they pay. And so what you're talking about, there's something called an office-based lab. And this is something that has been relatively new with Medicare. I talked to somebody about this earlier today. And with office-based labs, you have these doctors who are now allowed to do these procedures in their office. They don't need to go to a surgery center. They don't need to go to a hospital. They're doing it all under their roof. So they are definitely left unchecked. They see the patients in consultation, and then they have the patients have a procedure all there. And in some cases, they'll get paid about $30,000 for an encounter, depending upon what the patient is having done. You know, it's a combination of procedures. I see procedures where maybe they're doing more than one intervention on the patient. So I think $100,000 might be low in McCary's book.
Yeah.
Compared to some situations, again, it's going to depend on payer contracts and whatnot, a reimbursement. But the office-based lab issue that you're touching on here and going this direction, I just see like fraud and abuse, like all over it. Like
all
I just do, because they've relaxed the requirements. And because this is in my space, it's very concerning to me that you're basically leaving this unchecked. I feel that they need to probably audit office-based labs for medical necessity on these procedures.
Yeah, they definitely do. These things cannot be left unchecked. And if they do, then that's again where we just see this mass fraud. So the other thing that I'll just add to that is one of the first places that I worked was in a multi-specialty practice, and I worked a lot in the oncology department. So I would frequently have conversations with patients about what their out-of-pocket would be for their chemotherapy treatments. And it would break my heart to tell a 70-year-old woman that's on Social Security, that's already on a very fixed income, you have to show up to our office and be prepared 3 times a week to pay your out-of-pocket, which is, let's say, $5,000 times 3 times a week. So that's $15,000 a week. You need to be prepared for that.
Wow.
And I would have patients that would say, do you want me to eat or do you want me to get chemo? Because there's no choice here. I can never pay that. So it would just break my heart. But what was even more egregious and unfortunate is that I would see patients that were 80, 90 years old that were being put on chemotherapy, these crazy doses of chemotherapy.
Yeah.
And it's like, why are these patients being put on chemo? Because Medicare pays for the chemo, right? If they have a diagnosis, they get chemo. And guess what? You know, that organization gets a markup on all of their chemotherapy drugs. And oncology is a very lucrative specialty. So it
yes.
is, it's so unfortunate when you see patients that are already, you know, advanced age and that would have much better quality of life if they didn't have chemo, right? So these types of financial incentives, it disincentivizes good care, quality of care, because it's a fee-for-service model where the more you treat, the more you test, the more you diagnose, the more you add to that balance sheet, the more money you're going to make. That's, again, the problem with this very broken system.
Yeah, one of the things is it kind of ties into what you're saying here. I think it kind of ties in, or at least it made me think of this, where in the book, Dr. McCary was talking about how physicians are good at verbal triggers and steering the patients towards what they want the patients to do. They know the right things to say to the patients. So the physician already has the predetermined outcome of what they want the patient to do. So they frame the patient's situation in a way that the patient is going to choose what the physician wants them to do versus putting options out there to the patient. Again, going back to, particularly with Medicare beneficiaries, that trust in a physician for what is best for them. And they will always, almost every time, take that decision that the physician is making, and they don't even know that there's another option. It's not presented to them that there's another option. And it sounds like maybe in oncology, that might be the issue. Well, you have cancer and this is the prescribed treatment and this is what we do. And I've often thought of that. And like, when you hit a certain point in life, what's the quality of life for these people on this aggressive chemo? you know, they're going to pass away anyway with the chemo. The odds of them, how many people that age go into remission after chemo? Like, seriously. So is it really laid out for them, like the risks and the benefits? And I don't necessarily think that it is in some cases, you know, for that reason. So the physicians kind of steer down the paths, or also this kind of, we didn't get into prescribing, but we can look at this from prescriptions as well. You know, one of the things you learn from the book, if you didn't already know it, is there's like prescriptions have gone up. I forget the percentage that prescriptions have gone up in this country over the years, but there's so much over prescribing like done. Physicians are so quick to write prescriptions for everything. So why is that? Well, I think there's two reasons for it. One is, I think from the patient perspective, sometimes patients are lazy and don't want to make lifestyle changes, so they'd rather take a pill. That's an aspect of it. But I think that's a smaller aspect of the bigger problem. I think the bigger issue is that physicians are incentivized to push prescriptions and to push medications. And I'm one of those people who I avoid taking any prescription medication. It is always a last resort for me. I will not do it. I feel very strongly about that. And I don't feel that physicians bother educating patients on risks, on lifestyle changes, things like that. Like, nobody talks about it. Like, let's even talk about diabetes. Like, you know, we have the epidemic of, you know, diabetes in this country. Why are providers not talking to their patients and educating them about lifestyle choices? And diabetes in most cases is reversible. And I don't think that most people understand that, that there are things that you can do. Not everybody is it reversible. There are certain points where it's not, but it is. And nobody is focusing on preventative things that you can do through diet, lifestyle, whatever, you know, maybe natural remedies for certain things. It's all about prescriptions. But again, it's the money being pumped into the system, and doctors are kind of pushed towards certain prescribing patterns and prescribing certain medications. So I guess we will wrap up with this because we've been talking for a while, but you know, Rosemee, you wanted to talk about the overprescribing of opioids specifically. That was covered in the book.
I'll give two examples very quickly. I had a gallbladder surgery about 10 years ago, and I was given prescription painkillers, opioids, and I don't remember the name. I believe it was hydrocodone, but I could not tolerate it. You know, it was making me nauseous. I did not feel good after taking it. So when I called the doctor, he told me, okay, just take regular Tylenol, you know, and I took the Tylenol. So I had a prescription for 30 days. I had a bottle full of hydrocodone for 30 days. And I think there was a refill in there too, but I didn't end up taking it. Right. So that bottle of hydrocodone is a lot of money out there on the black market, right? And the same thing happened with my mom, who had a knee replacement surgery last year. Same thing, Tramadol, she couldn't tolerate it. You know, she couldn't tolerate, she had to take it for about 2 days after surgery because the pain was very bad. But then after that, she didn't even take it. She was just taking Tylenol and it was perfectly fine. But I think Dr. McCary talks about the fact that that's how they were trained. Yes. You know, it's like, as a surgeon, that's how, he didn't even think twice about it. He was just like, okay, surgery done, 30 days of opioids, right?
Yeah.
Didn't think as to where these,
that was a standard were. Practice.
That was a standard of care. And he's helping change that now. But I can see how these pills can end up in the wrong hands.
Definitely.
And my dad was on very heavy medication. He was a heart patient. He had prostate cancer, passed away 3 years ago here in my house. And so after he passed away, we had a bag full of pills, prescription pills, that we were just like, my husband and I are looking at each other. We're like, what are we going to do about this? And our city here actually has a cleanup twice a year where they take all the you know, prescription medication and everything. You can just take, and there's like law enforcement officer standing, of course, no questions asked, but they take everything so they don't end up in the wrong hands. So I think that's a really good system, but I can easily see how we got to the point we are at right now in this country with the opioid crisis. So that's what I wanted to
There was obviously, well, the minimizing of the opioid issue obviously was a big thing. Drug companies don't want anybody knowing what's really going on with opioids. Again, it goes back to that. What was interesting, I had written down these numbers, if we did talk about it with the opioid prescribing, that when McCary had that group of people together and they were doing a study of like what the appropriate amounts of opioids were for different procedures, that they came up with, for some procedures, zero is the appropriate amount, even though they had been getting them. For other procedures, they only needed 5 days. And then for other procedures, they only needed 10. They found in most cases that you didn't need to exceed 10 days of opioids. But like you said, it came from their training. It was standard practice. And so I also think about, because we know that they're highly addictive, we've learned that over time. If you think about it, when a patient's given a prescription, you have some patients of the mindset with certain prescriptions, I have to finish the prescription. I have to take every pill in the bottle. Yes. No, you don't. I mean, if it's antibiotics, yes, you need to finish a course of it. But, and then I think people, you know, can get dependent on it that way when they're taking it unnecessarily, they don't realize it. And then some people become dependent on stuff quicker than other people. There's, I think, that aspect as well, where some people can take it and be perfectly fine. But yeah, the prescribing patterns, again, we all know about the opioid crisis, but when I was reading him describing what that, you know, was in practice, I was like, oh my goodness, no wonder why you have so many people, you know, who are addicted to these. And then you're right, the leftover medication that you get has amazing street value for resale. So now it's harder to get your hands on them. They're clamped down on that. But yeah, that was very eye-opening there to dig into the details of that. And he talked about how, you know, when we're talking about a public health crisis, that opioids is a public health crisis. And then also overprescribing of antibiotics was something else that he mentioned. Obviously, we've got all these resistant strains of everything. I mean, I can remember back in the day, what would the doctor do? He would prescribe you an antibiotic for anything. I had one doctor that used to be my PCP. You could never get in to see him. His solution was to prescribe you an antibiotic. And then if you're not better, come see me. So he didn't even know what was wrong with you. He did nothing and he was prescribing. And that's created a problem for all of us. So Tony, do you want to share any final thoughts before we wrap up?
I mean, I just think Dr. McCary is an incredible trailblazer. I have so much respect for this guy. I mean, this book really laid out in very plain English, like very understandable, some complicated stuff, right? Like he basically dissected a massive $1 trillion problem and broke it down and made it super digestible and simple. So I have so much respect for him. I think he is a pioneer, a trailblazer. He's also got a lot of things that he does philanthropically, like he serves as an expert witness in cases where patients are being sued and they're having like liens put on their houses and garnishments on their wages. So he will show up to court and testify as an expert witness pro bono. He doesn't charge for his time. And he's basically said in every single instance where he's done that, the hospital has backed down and not proceeded with suing these patients. He'll even go as far as to read the hospital charters in these hearings. So he'll like read out, okay, this hospital is here to serve patients, is going to care for all patients, regardless of their ability to pay. They are a hand extended from Jesus Christ. And so he'll read this stuff and the judges will just, you know, like their mouths are on the ground and the cases will get dismissed. So for somebody that's a surgeon, that's already incredibly busy, that's a professor, to take time out of his already crazy, hectic life to write this book, to be an advocate, to raise awareness, and to go out and do these things pro bono, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievably philanthropic. And I just think the guy is a hero.
Yeah, I can echo that. I don't know how he finds the time to do everything that he does. Reading this book, all the trips he went on across the country and all these people he visited. And I'm sure he's not getting paid for any of this stuff that he's doing and going around there. And I like how he took, I feel like the biggest issues in healthcare that need to be addressed and put them all in one book. And he didn't just outline the issues for us, but he also, within each issue, gave us an example of people who are disrupting the system and they have proven methods. And I feel that if these other methods could catch on, again, it goes back to what we've said over and over again. It's the money, follow the money in healthcare. If we could get the politics out of it, then it would definitely be better for everyone else. But no, I'm amazed like by his book. It was incredibly written. Like, I'm one of those people, I'll like get a little bit into a book, I'll read a couple chapters and I'll put it down and then I will maybe never get back to it. I picked up his book and I think I read through it the first time in probably like a day and a half. You know, I was like done with it. I couldn't stop reading it because I just found the story so compelling. And then I read it a second time when we talked about doing a podcast on the book. So I've gone through it twice now. And maybe one of these days, I would love to have a conversation with him. I want to meet Dr. McCary and I want to talk to him. That's like on my bucket list there to like make that happen. So I want to reach out to him and it'd be cool to have him on the podcast maybe to discuss his book and his thoughts and go into things more in depth. So Rosemean, do you want to share any final thoughts before we wrap up?
I'll echo whatever both of you said. I mean, he's a trailblazer. He's a pioneer. He's a beacon of hope. Really, and I hope that most more people will follow in what he has already put in motion. You know, more people will follow and more people will see where the corruption is and, you know, what's going on in this system here. So I hope that people, you know, let's keep the conversation going. That's what I'm going to say. And let's get more people on board so we can disrupt this in our lifetime, hopefully.
Yeah, definitely. He's a doctor who gets it. Like, he gets the big picture. And so many physicians are so busy with all their patients and all the red tape and all the I don't think that they don't want to know. They don't know. And they're just so busy and like overwhelmed and caught up in the bureaucracy of healthcare that they're not aware of the bigger picture and the finer details. Like, we even know as medical coding professionals, sometimes trying to talk to them about medical coding, it's like another language and there's a little bit of a disconnect there. And then when you step outside of the picture, I think it's great that Dr. McCary has written this book and he does engage with other physicians and talk to other physicians, because we all know the best way is peer to peer. That's just simply, you know, the way it is. Like, even as coders, we can talk to a physician till we're blue in the face. But if there's another physician that, you know, respects us and values our opinion and this other doctor won't listen to us, he will listen to his physician buddy, like, hey, this is what I learned from medical coding person over here. You need to listen to them. There's just something about that peer-to-peer. So I love the fact that he did the book. And I probably will even read it again, like in the future. It's one of those books I wouldn't mind reading again. So for the listeners, just a reminder, the book that we've been talking about, it's called The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It by Dr. Marty McCary. And you can find that in paperback on Amazon. So thank you, Tony, for joining me for this podcast, and also Rosemean. I appreciate it. And thank you to all the listeners.
Thank you, Stacey.
Thanks, Stacey. This was so much fun.
That brings us to the final part of the discussion about The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. Thank you, Rosemean and Tony, for sharing your thoughts on this important topic. I hope it has been an eye-opening series of interviews for all of my listeners. And I highly recommend, if you have not already done so, pick up a copy of Dr. McCary's book. It absolutely is a must read. I've said it before and I'll say it again. And if you have already read the book, I would love to hear your thoughts. You can send an email to podcast@radrx.com or share them with me on LinkedIn. And as always, I want to thank all of my loyal listeners. If you are loving the podcast and listen on Apple, please take a moment to give the podcast a 5-star rating and leave a review. And of course, as always, please share it with your friends and colleagues. If you have feedback you'd like to share in an episode or topic suggestion, please send an email to podcast@radrx.com. That's podcast@radrx.com. Thanks for tuning in and have an amazing week.
Thank you for listening to Who Cares What Stacy Says. You can connect with Stacy on social media. You can find her business page for RadRx on Facebook, and you can connect with her personally on LinkedIn. Don't forget to check out the online training courses offered by RadRx. Cracking the IR Code, Mastering Interventional Radiology and Cardiology Online Training, or Cracking the Diagnostic Radiology Code Online Training. Thanks again for tuning in to Who Cares What Stacy Says? A podcast providing insights and advice on how to take your medical coding career to the next level.